Recognized by people who work in the field that the actual pickup capacity is something less than that and can be substantially less than that, because those numbers come from the manufacturer under laboratory conditions generally, and they do not reflect what your actual pickup rate might be in the field.
So what you're saying is
something,
but that has nothing to do with the current plan,
because that number is not involved in the 87 plan, which is the plan we're now talking about.
Okay, then let's talk about dispersants. All right, you don't want to talk about skimming, let's talk about dispersants. I'd be happy to talk about dispersants. The dispersant assumption is, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's 10 to the minus 3 times 4 for the depth of the oil. Now, is that realistic? Given a 200,000 barrel spill, is that a realistic assumption that it will spread out to 4/1,000ths of 1 inch over the size of the spill which you have here?
For the depth of the oil.
I don't know the numbers you're talking
about.
Well,
they're in another one of your letters, but perhaps this has been superseded too. I'm not sure. It's right here. This is now, again, this is 1986, and perhaps we're not dealing with this anymore, but it says here, and using the, you're talking about correct. You're talking about number of drums, you're talking about where it'll come from, and you're saying that you know, you're going to use it on oil that has spread over, this is a small spill, 1,000 barrels, to 4/1,000ths of 1 inch. Now, the question is, how far would your 200,000 barrel spill have to spread to be 4/1,000ths of 1 inch thick so that the Corexit would work?
Well, the Corexit could work if it's thicker than that. It just means you apply it in larger droplets and you tailor the application to fit the situation. That is one particular scenario, one set of assumptions under which the calculation is shown as to how much dispersant would cover how much area. But you could have an infinite number of situations and combinations that, but you design the application with the help of an expert to meet that circumstance.
Okay, do you agree with what ADEC said, that they did not impede you from using the dispersants? In fact, it was in the class one area, and you had basically blanket authority to use them, and there were three attempts to use them, and apparently two attempts were very marginal, and the third attempt showed some effect.
That they did not impede you from
after
using,
6 o'clock on Friday, when most of those discussions are being held, Alyeska was not part of that discussion. You know, it was Exxon.
So you're in on the dispersant planning, but you passed it off to Exxon, so we're going to have to ask Exxon that question, even though you...
We requested authority. We carried through exactly our obligations. We did it both orally and written to the Coast Guard, so they would be in a position to apply the dispersant. Then, as I said, Exxon took over the considerations of dispersant. Those discussions were held, and the kind of discussion you're talking about, we were not into that, and I have no knowledge of what happened in those discussions.
Okay, did you, in planning the contingency...
Exxon took over the considerations of
I'll yield shortly to my colleague from Illinois, Inland, but let me just... two more.
I have no knowledge of what happened in those discussions. Okay, did you, in planning the contingency...
Okay. In planning for the major spill, or in developing a contingency plan for that, you know, I mean, you are responsible for basically telling us a little bit about the reality of the spill. And in planning for that spill, did you say it's likely that, given a rupture, you had one which was, I think, 10,000 barrels per hour, one which was an immediate rupture. What did this come closer to, the immediate rupture of the 200,000 barrels or the 10,000 barrels per hour? Which was
this was close to the immediate, because all of the oil essentially was out by daylight. It was out in 3 to 5 hours. The bulk of it was.
Okay, so it's close to the immediate rupture, which you consider to be the least likely possibility. But my understanding is the oil was of some extraordinary depth around the ship initially, the spill, and that perhaps
even had there been booms available, they wouldn't have worked.
Well, the oil was fairly thick. It took a while to spread, but by sunup, it already had spread to an area that was better than 3 by 2 miles. And in the first estimate of it was 3, 2 by 5, but I think it was closer to like 2 by 3 or something. But it spread very quickly to something that was relatively thin, a fraction of an inch.
Okay, so it could, at that point, booms could have been effective.
You could have encircled it and held it for a while, which is what we did in leading edge. We were able to hold it, to keep it in the zone one area through Saturday and Sunday while we worked on it, picking it up the best we could with our skimmers and position it for the strike of the dispersant. And that's and bringing in other mechanical pickup equipment, because there was a lot on the way. So we did contain it, in a sense, hold it in that channel as long as we could till the winds came up. Sunday afternoon, they start blowing 40 miles an hour, and by, and then, of course, Monday, it was 70 miles an hour.
But you had the ideal conditions that were anticipated in the contingency plan for that interim period, and yet you couldn't pick up any significant amount, you couldn't disperse any significant amount, nor could you burn any significant amount during that. You had basically had 48 hours of grace, given the weather that I've seen prevail around here, and you couldn't do anything with it.
Well, we were obviously disappointed. There wasn't more dispersant used and more burning. Yes.
I yield back, balance my time.
That was Mr. Congressman Fazio. Here is Congressman Durbin.
Yes.
He's the one who wrote this letter that we've been talking about. I was just curious, is he with you today?
No, he's not, sir.
Bet you wish this letter would go away, don't you?
Sir?
It's going to be a pain for a long time for you to explain it, and I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Instead of going through it again, because my colleagues have covered it all that they possibly could, or perhaps we'll find another angle to approach it, let me try to get down to something that your company did promise, that you and I can both agree that you did promise. First, it seems to me that one of the conditions for your doing business, big business, major national business, was to present to not only the state of Alaska, but also to the nation at large, your assurance in this document that should some disaster occur, you were prepared to handle it. You'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, we try to portray what could happen in certain circumstances. That's true.
And do you think if you had put in this document, instead of what you thought might happen, what actually happened when the Exxon Valdez ran into the Bly Reef, that any agency of government, state or federal, would have given you permission to pump oil through the pipeline?
Well, the plan for the 200,000 barrel case did a reasonably accurate job of projecting what would happen in a 200,000 barrel scenario. It said that we would apply our mechanical pickup, we would call in more equipment, we would hit it with dispersants, and we still would have oil on the beach.
Now let me tell you what else you promised. Then let me tell you what else you promised in this 200,000 barrel scenario. I'm going to quote you here. This isn't something we're making up from a man who's not here, from a letter you disavow. This is something that your company presented. It is estimated that approximately 50% of the oil will be recovered at sea.
Recovered with dispersant.
Either directly after the spill or at a later time by being washed off the rocks, contained and skimmed off of the water.
But recovery in this sense means recovery mechanically or through use of dispersants or burning.
Now it goes on to say 15% of the oil will naturally disperse, 5% remain in the environment. Do you really believe that you're going to be able to recover 50% of what the Exxon Valdez spilled in the Prince William Sound?
Well, what I was addressing was the 50% recovery mentioned there is a recovery including mechanical, dispersant, and burning. It's all three.
You still think that's a possibility? You still think that's a possibility?
Well, we don't know what dispersants could have done because they weren't allowed early.
Well, let me just tell you what has been done. The maximum amount that anyone's been able to recover in terms of what the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation tells us, was 2,000 barrels a day. And you know what it's down to now as of May 5th? 200 barrels a day. That's a long, long way to 120,000 barrels, half of it. I don't see how you're going to do this. I don't see how you can make this representation. How much? Now, one of the things you said earlier puzzled me. You said, well, you had so many barrels of dispersant on hand when this occurred, and there was others you could bring together. How much?
I'm not quite sure of the numbers, but I think on Saturday...
Excuse me, sir. Excuse me, but that's a pretty important number, isn't it? Because if you're suggesting that the only thing between the disaster that we've seen in Prince William Sound and your rosy scenario in this plan was the amount of dispersant that could be used, you ought to know how much you had.
Well, it wouldn't have mattered. It would have had 10,000 barrels because the permission wasn't given. I mean, sorry, back off of that. But I mean, during the period where it could have been applied, it was not. And the window was missed. It could have been in there. But I... You know, the discussions after Friday, I wasn't in on those. But the amount of dispersant that we had on Saturday, I think, was on the order of about 600 barrels or something of that order.
Now, how much...
Or drums, I guess they are.
Yeah, how much would 600 drums, how much could you use 600 drums? What would you expect it to impact the oil spill? How much?
Well, it depends on what the appropriate multiplier is. There are some who believe the number of multiplier is as high as 80 to 100. There are others who believe it's as low as 20. If you believe it is as high as
80. Talk to me in terms
80.
Of barrels. You're going to throw me here. If you talk about drums and gallons,
okay.
If you can talk about some barrels of oil that could have impacted.
Let's just say that you had 1,000 barrels. I'm not sure what the number is, but let's assume it's 1,000. That's roughly. If you had 1,000, if you had a multiplier of 20, that's 20,000 barrels. If the multiplier were 100, that's 100,000 barrels it could impact. So it depends what the multiplier is if you had 1,000, hypothetically 1,000 barrels of dispersant.
Oh, one part dispersant for 20 parts.
That's the conservative estimate. The more liberal go up much higher. In our plan, we use the conservative estimate of 20 to 1.
It looks to me like the state of Alaska isn't too impressed with your dispersants, with their new plan that they've come up with here, because it seems to me that what they're asking you to do now is to have the capability of scooping up spilled oil at the rate of 10,000 barrels per hour. Is that correct?
Nameplate.
I love this nameplate. And let me tell you, let's play the nameplate game a little further. Under the old contingency plan, that rate was about 2,700 barrels an hour. And that, incidentally, what a coincidence. That just tracks Mr. Hilliger's letter. 2,700 barrels an hour, 48 hours, guess what? We're right at 100,000 barrels. I can't get over. The state of Alaska is stuck with the same problem we're stuck with. They think you made a promise.
No, sir. I don't. You talking about this, the current order that we're addressing now, is that
yes.
What you're talking about?
Yes. Yes.
And we're working with them. We have the equipment on the way that I mentioned earlier that has a nameplate capacity of the 10,000 barrels an hour pickup. You talking
about this? Well, sir, let me tell you something. You made a promise to a lot of people with this document. And without that promise, I don't think you'd have been in business. And if you would have put in this document what actually occurred, I don't think you'd have been in business. And then as soon as the first disaster came up, you know what you did? You handed it off to another company. Now, it must be confusing out of Alyeska to figure out who your boss is. But as far as I can determine, Alyeska made the promises in here, and Alyeska didn't live up to those promises. You may have handed it off to another company, but quite honestly, I believe you've abused the basic trust which was given to your company, which said if you want to do business in this highly technical industry with this potential for disaster, you've got to be prepared to deliver should a disaster occur. You can make all the excuses you want about nameplates and letters that don't count, but the fact is a lot of damage was done when a lot of people thought it could have been avoided. You had optimum weather conditions there for 2 or 3 days, and it appears that this oil spill just went across the sound, and eventually hundreds of square miles were devastated by it. I think if you'd have written that into your plan, I think your business would have been closed down. That's unfortunate for a lot of people living in Alaska, but this disaster is unfortunate for those people and a lot of others as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hundreds of square miles were devastated by it.
Those statements by Richard Durbin of Illinois.
I think it's clear that the answers have not yet satisfied the panel. In the contingency report,
this is George Miller.
You have told us that your interpretation of the contingency report is that you would be able to meet the goals of the contingency report with the use of dispersants. That being a major component of what you expected to do. Is that what you're telling me?
Plus burning, sir.
Plus burning. You weren't involved in the burning at all, as I understand. That came much after.
The test was done on Saturday, as I remember.
How much, let me just ask you this, what was your, how much burning boom did you have? How many feet of boom that's, apparently it's a specialized boom that's necessary to burn?
The first, I think, I don't remember the numbers exactly, I think the first day we had about 500 feet, then we had another 2,200 or 2,400 or 2,600 feet that was flown in from Seattle, and so we would have had by sometime, and I have to go back and look, on Saturday or Sunday, we would have had the additional.
When did the boom from Seattle arrive?
I'm not sure. I just don't recall, sir.
Can anybody tell us? Nobody knows?
We have to look in the record. I just don't know, sir.
Back to the dispersants. My point that you now say that this, that everybody should have understand that it was dispersants that were key to this 200,000 barrel scenario. On page 3.3-6, you start out under the discussion of dispersants about how they can be properly used and they can reduce the interfacial tension. And in the third paragraph, it says the use of dispersants should not be considered a cleanup technique. And while obviously you believe in dispersants as does much of the industry and many of the people in the scientific field, you also state there that each spill situation must be assessed in light of the full range of spill responses and options available. The relative merits of chemical dispersion versus non-dispersion must be considered for specific oil, environment, and season associated with the spill. What if we would have been in the middle of the salmon run? What if you would have been outside of zone one? What would you have done with 200,000 barrels then?
Well, you would have gone to the RRT or through the Coast Guard to the RRT with a request for a consideration. They can still make the decision. It's a relative risk. At that point, do you make the choice to use dispersants, or do you say, no, I will not, I will take my chance for it hitting the shore? And it's a choice that the RRT would have to make as a committee, 12 federal agencies plus the ADEC. And it's their call as to which way would go. And
so essentially, there's obviously no capability within the skimmers to handle this spill in that 48-hour, 72-hour period. I mean, if you guys worked at nameplate capacity with the skimmers you had out there, you couldn't do it. Exactly.
That's right. That's right. Not a 200,000 barrel in that.
So then the choice that is left to the state or the choice is left to the federal government or the Coast Guard, whichever agency makes the decision, is one, because of the spill, to go ahead and risk the salmon fisheries or risk the environment in zone three or I guess which is the most sensitive or zone two. Or do nothing because you don't have the capability to manage the spill in any significant fashion. Not 50% of it apparently without dispersants. Not 100,000 barrels in 48 hours. So you see the problem I'm left with?
And what you do is you assess each situation. We had our spills in January. We were able to contain it with our equipment, and we would not have even considered dispersant in those cases.
That spill's an asterisk alongside of this.
I understand, sir. And this one, you look at all the circumstances and the equipment. Now, obviously, we will have a great deal more equipment May 15th or June 1 than we had before. We're learning, we responded, we all agreed on what was a plan that was adequate for everybody's concern, the state, the feds, and ours, as a good risk, a good situation to play to. And now we learn from it, and we're going to have more equipment. But more importantly, we're going to have escorts on the ships going out. Those ships will have the ability to boom early. We've enhanced our ability for safe passage dramatically. And what we want to do is keep it from happening. That's the most important thing. Better radar coverage, better radio coverage, better pilot coverage, and escort vessels. And those four things significantly improve our ability to operate without a repeat performance.
If that's good policy now, why wasn't it good policy a month ago?
You learn from the experience. In this case, we learned what happened. We just learned from it. We all learn in our life as we go along. And we do the best job we can with collective judgment. You get together with the smartest and best people you can, and you try to come to the conclusion of what's a reasonable way to structure your business. We got together the state, the federal government, and our own consultants, and the plan was what we had. And we've committed, we fulfilled our promises in that plan. We have not broken our promises to the people of this state. We have fulfilled the promises in that plan.
Well, let me suggest that you haven't, and this obviously is a difference of opinion. But there is no indication that you had any ability to affect the outcome of this spill in the last 45 days. None. Not by burning it, not by dispersing it, not by skimming it, not by giving it the leading edge. None of that. Other than the attempt that was made on the hatcheries. Other than that, this spill is wandering around Prince William Sound. It is wandering down the Alaska Peninsula, as it might any day of the week. There is no indication of any impact. You are now managing a mess. You are now cleaning up rocks and polishing rocks, and people are out there busting their buns on rainy, drizzly days. That's not cleanup. That's not what people expected in terms of the ability to affect and to mitigate the impact of this spill. The notion is that you can somehow reduce the amount of oil that's going to get to shore, that you can pick it up. You just told us that there's no way you could tell us the circumstances under which you would pick up 100,000 barrels of oil in 48 hours, and you've disavowed the letter that everybody here has talked about. Well, you've just committed yourself to picking up 100,000 barrels of oil in 10 hours under the proposal you're entering into the state.
There's no guarantee. It says we will have that equipment.
Well, then I'm going to tell you, I'm going to leave this hearing and go call the governor. And I'm going to tell the governor, don't do it, because you're running the same path that got us here. There's no guarantee. I guess what he should do is, on this nameplate ranking, he should ask you to commit yourself to 1 million barrels of oil in 10 hours, and then you'd be able to perhaps do. Because that's what we're being told here, is that somehow we can't find the pea under the walnut. Because you keep moving it, because you have nameplate rated, but the conditions, as we all know, affect that. The capabilities to get there, not get there, and all that. And now you're telling us that while this didn't work out, you can now commit yourself to a plan. I don't have the grid here, but what you say, you want to look toward the future. The grid in the plan says you do 10,566 barrels per hour at the eighth hour.
That's the collection of equipment at that site. That's correct, sir. But the emphasis on the plan, or this one of the main emphasis, is that you have really strengthened dramatically the oversight on the vessel going out. Remember, both those escort vessels have the capability alone to control that vessel, that ship tanker, if it loses power. They have the ability to keep it from going on the rocks. You've got two sets of eyes that are watching that ship constantly. You spend and you do everything you can to keep this from ever happening again.
If you learn from your experience, you had a ship lose power for a good number of hours, a number of years ago. Why weren't escort vessels being used now?
We have escort, as you do know, I believe, from the Narrows Inn. That has always been the case. When the system was set up, you had escort of the tugs on the outgoing with the loaded tanker through the Narrows. You had pilots and you had radar coverage out through that section. And that was considered at that time to be more than enough security, hopefully, to keep this from ever happening. And it was stated as a very unlikely event. Never was said to be impossible.
Then was that discontinued?
No. No.
You've always had the two tug escort?
No, we've always had one tug just for that section. But now we've gone to two tugs. In fact, one tug would be sufficient. This is double safety. One tug alone could do it very well, but we're sending two. And not only that, one of those will be a response vessel that will have boom on it, that will have skimmers, have work boats to work very quickly around the ship if it gets in trouble. But the key is, each of those is capable of controlling that ship.
So now, what's that going to cost you per day?
I have seen numbers that, I'm not sure what the number is, but it could be very well in the order of a
Gosh, I don't know.
There's a reported figure, I think, in the press.
I really don't know. I haven't been involved in calculating those numbers.
There's a reported figure in the press about $200,000 a day.
It sounds somewhat high to me, but I don't know exactly what it is.
Oh.
It's a substantial amount of money. I don't know what it is, though, because I haven't calculated it.
Gentlemen,
yeah,
Morgan.
I just want to follow up on this.
Yeah.
You're telling us that now you are guaranteeing that in any conditions, one of those tugs can control the movement of that ship. You're saying it's redundant, you've got two, one can handle it. You're saying in any conditions that you could foresee out here through the whole sound, that you're guaranteeing that one of those tugs can control the movement of that ship and prevent an accident.
I think you put it correctly. Any condition that I can foresee, they have the power.
What about ice? As I understand it, when they get into ice, the tugs follow the tankers because the tugs are not real good at dealing with the large icebergs.
Well, they all slow down through the area, and the escort vessels will stay with the ship.
Right, but if the ship loses power, they're going to need to not be hiding behind it going through the ice.
Well, I don't know where they'll be in the process, but they will be close by to where they could respond to help the ship.
So you absolute guarantee, can't envision anything.
Well, no, I didn't say that. I said that the condition that I can't envision a situation where those two tugs couldn't manage the ship.
Is this nameplate capacity one tug, or is this actual capacity one tug?
These are actual capacity one tugs.
You know, you get the sense of frustration, and maybe it's because we're lay people in your industry, but so are our constituents. And my constituents thought I should come up here and hang one of you, but I thought we'd have a hearing instead. And I also have to be able to go back and to give them answers. And right now, I don't have the answers that I can give to people that would lead me to believe, to make an intelligent decision, that this system ought to continue on as it has, or as you're now proposing in this May 1st report. And the reason that is because you cannot define for me. And I used to sail on tankers, and I've sailed on tugs, and I don't expect precision in terms of numbers. But what I do expect is you be able to tell me in a very candid fashion what you will or what you will not be able to do under certain circumstances to the best of your expectations. And right now what I hear you telling me is you're relying on nameplate rating, and that will certify that you have a certain capacity, and then there's going to be a whole set of downside variables that will reduce that capacity. Some may be within your control and some without your control. And I understand. But when you have 200,000 barrels of oil on the water, you're going to have to get that nameplate capacity way up there to put any confidence into the people of Prince William Sound or the people of California or the Congress of the United States. Now, it goes to the other arguments that you're making here today that doesn't quite follow me. You suggested dispersants were the key. There was a window of opportunity with respect to dispersants, which was apparently that time before the very large winds that scattered the oils, and maybe you could have used them afterwards, but whatever. There was that moment there where you had apparently the weather conditions, although you had thicker oil. About 10 million gallons of oil on the water in some fashion out there drifting from the ship. You had how much dispersant at Valdez facility? You've had approval for what, about a week? Early March you had approval of the use of dispersants. Is that correct?
I understand that the RRT approved the zonation map. It was March 8th. Approval, and we got word of it sometime after that.
Okay.
But it had been approved. Yes.
And so at the time of the spill, you had how much dispersant on hand? You said
I think that on Saturday the number was something Saturday or Sunday. It's like 600, Saturday, I think it was about 600 barrels. Or it was, they're actually drums, and they each have 55 gallons, and a barrel in the oil field is 42 gallons. So it's something greater than that number, ratioed by 55 over 42.
Was it, you had 600 what we call barrels?
Drums, yes.
Drums.
Roughly, it was approximately that number.
And where was the rest of the dispersant?
Pardon?
And where was the rest of the dispersant?
Exxon had ordered in a larger quantity that was being flown in, and it was coming in. That was, and it, more of it arrived Sunday, and more arrived Monday, and more arrived Tuesday, and they had a lot of it coming in after that.
How much was that?
You probably should ask Exxon how much they had here by that time. I'm not sure of those numbers, because we really just sort of handled it real early, and then it turned it over to them.
And this essentially was over by Sunday, was it not?
As far as the window for dispersants, because of the high wind.
So how much was there?
You could have used it later, but
how much was there by Sunday morning?
I really don't know, sir. I don't have that number in transition.
Well, you know, the ratios that we used early, the 20-to-1 ratio suggests you needed 500. You know, what did you need? You need 500,000 gallons.
Yeah, whatever ratio. If the ratio is 20-to-1. Yes, like as I say, there's some who argue that it's 80-to-1 or 100-to-1, but the 20-to-1, which is a conservative number, we used. You probably correct.
Well, you used, and the state used, and NOAA used, and everybody else used
as a conservative basis
in putting together the contingency plan.
That's correct.
You didn't have the conservative dispersants on hand for 200,000 barrels.
Well, we didn't, because we didn't have the approval yet through the agency to have it. That's what we were working on. We worked very hard in that 2.5 year period to get
so how much dispersants are you going to stockpile now under the new plan?
It depends if we have talked to the state, because right now this order, this interim order, doesn't include the use of dispersants, and we're going to have to talk to them about that. We believe it's a very important tool to be used, and that will be decided in the plan, which has to now be completed by August 1.
Are you stockpiling it now?
Pardon?
Are you stockpiling dispersants now?
Yes, we have something on the order of about 900 to 1,000 barrels of dispersant at the moment, and two ADS packs.
You had 500 feet of fire boom present?
That was used in the first test, and then I say we had the other fire boom coming from Seattle. And it got, and I'm not quite sure when it got here, because at that time Exxon was really controlling the decisions on the burning, and it was flown in almost immediately, though.
Friday morning. How much can you burn with 500 feet of boom?
Well, they burn, whatever it is they burn, 16 or 18,000 gallons. I heard them referred to earlier. That was burned in that particular, that was a smaller boom, a burn. And I'm not sure how much they could have. That's how much they decided to test.
In this proposal, that the least British Petroleum says is going to be very expensive to run, are you going to change the nature of your crew operation at Alyeska in terms of the response team, the drill team, the people who respond, or are you going to leave that the same as it was?
Well, there will be a whole separate organization manning all this equipment. In the plan, we show the management, the supervision, the control of the whole process. And there's something on the order of 50 people or so involved in that whole plan that's put together there in response to the emergency order.
They will be responsible to who?
For the time being, it's with Alyeska. It's part of, we are working the order with the state, yes.
Stones.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Shard, just very briefly to understand the earlier, make sure I understand your earlier references to those conversations of instructions not to boom. There's no electronic recording of those instructions, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Not from the Alyeska side. What they may have had on the ship, I'm not sure.
Were those conversations, in fact, with the ship?
Yes, they were.
Direct? Between you and the ship?
Yes.
Not with the Coast Guard.
Oh, I'm sorry. The ship has a place. But my understanding, yes, it was with a Coast Guard person on board the ship.
So you were having a direct conversation with a Coast Guard officer who was aboard the Valdez?
Yes.
Jimmy, you?
Yes.
Communications with all your ships as they move back and forth.
Prior to the incident, prior to the order, we had VHF coverage, Marine VHF, from Valdez Terminal to a point approximately Bligh Reef or slightly south, depending on atmospherics.
At that point, you lose contact.
From the terminal VHF set, contact could be made via marine operator, Coast Guard, other devices.
So it was the Coast Guard that was telling you not to string the boom 35 hours?
Oh, no, not 35 hours.
You didn't string any booms, if that's the right term, till 35 hours after the accident?
No, that's not correct.
Yeah, when you say 35 hours after the spill, we hadn't strung any booms, that's incorrect. We
around the ship, around the Valdez.
To boom around the vessel. The vessel was boomed on Saturday, and the boom was begun, booming activities to encircle the Baton Rouge, and the Valdez was begun at around 11:30.
Well, that's 35 hours after the accident, right?
Yeah, but yeah, for the booming of the tankers, but there was, you said that...
Okay. It's correct for the booming of the vessel.
Let me show you a document prepared by the Alaskan Division of Department of Environmental Conservation called Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Oil Cleanup Effectiveness, the first 72 hours. Have you seen this document?
No, sir, I have not.
Can staff provide the witness with a copy? This shows three graphs. The first graph indicates that wind speed was ideal for 62 hours, as I read it, approximately 60 hours, suitable for skimmers, it says. The second graph shows that the length of the slick was relatively small for those same 62-64 hours. The third graph is the damning one. It says that the Alyeska contingency plan would have provided that within about 68 hours of this spill, you should have recovered 240,000 barrels of oil, whereas 4 hours later you had recovered only 3,000. Now that sets forth a plan of arrival for different skimmers, tankers, boom material, and so forth. Do you have any explanation for that? Does that not, in fact, contradict what you said earlier about your contingency plan?
I really would prefer to comment on this in writing because I do not understand how they calculated their numbers on the barrels recovered. On the dimensions of the spill, perhaps that was measured in terms of a 5-mile length in, you know, about 40 hours. That's probably about right, the length of the spill. But as far as the barrels recovered, I simply do not understand how they got those numbers.
Well, they're spelled out below the graph.
I would have to study it. I do not understand it.
Said your contingency plan provided within 4 hours for the arrival of boom and three skimmers with a capacity of 1,400 barrels an hour.
But again, you see that the plan called for an arrival under exactly those scenario conditions. If the conditions were not identical or close to that, which they were not, then that arrival time is not a valid measure.
Well, if the conditions are that the equipment was not ready, I'll certainly stipulate to that. You certainly agreed.
What I'm saying is we had the complication of the lightering and other factors, but I'm saying that is not a proper point to start from. It's my only point, sir.
Well, I'll appreciate your written explanation, because the oral one doesn't make any sense at all, if I may be so straightforward. So I'll appreciate that. Let me refer you to another document. 2.5 years ago, in a letter written to the Department of Environmental Conservation, Ray, oil spill contingency plan, it says that you can expect that a 200,000 barrel spill would occur only once every 241 years. And 2.5 years later, we had that event. It also says all of the equipment listed in the marine terminal section of the oil spill contingency plan is located at the Valdez terminal. Now, I have this contingency equipment Valdez terminal marine equipment list, and it sets forth 3 tugs, 5 workboats, 2 mooring launches, 1 contingency barge, Marco class 7 belt skimmer, Marco class 5 belt skimmer, 1 of each, a Vicoma sea skimmer disc, 1, Marco class 1 skimmer, 1, Comera 3, Slurp 3, whatever that means, Slick Skim Manta Ray 3. Now that says, in essence, that there are in the Valdez terminal at that point, as I count it, 13 skimmers. But your testimony says nothing comparable, as I understand it.
For instance, the class 1 is a small skimmer, a small boat of some 20-somewhat feet in length, not suitable for service out beyond the Narrows.
Well, see, that isn't the question. The question is whether this equipment, which your letter of 2.5 years ago indicates is in the terminal and prepared, whether that in fact...
It was at the terminal, yes.
All of that equipment was there and ready to be used.
Yes, sir. It was certain. That's correct.
It also says that...
Except that there were some... I guess someone told me there was some little chicken wire and... axe and 300 feet or so of boom, but we had more room in that to offset it. But essentially, everything was there.
I didn't go through all that. I just went through this other equipment. Yeah. So you're stating that all that equipment was there.
Yes, sir.
Prepared and ready to go.
Yes.
When the accident occurred. Except the barge, contingency barge, which you had explained had not been repaired from some leaks of 2 months earlier. I think that's your previous testimony.
But he was ready and he did go out. It was serviceable. Yes, sir.
It says further in that letter that an inventory of this equipment is conducted twice a year to assure that all equipment is available, and a notification is made to ADEC if any significant equipment required by the oil spill contingency plan is non-operational.
That's
for more than 3 days.
And non-operational means non-serviceable and not on site. And all the equipment was serviceable and on site.
Well, you testified earlier that the contingency barge was...
It was serviceable. We used it as it was. We took it out and it worked for weeks out in the Sound.
It was not repaired, but it was workable.
Send it out. It was serviceable. Yes. It was well above. It was near the top of the barge. It was just a crack in the seam that we thought we would get fixed, but it did not make the barge inoperable.
Well, then your written explanation as to why, if you had all the equipment you're supposed to have in your contingency plan, that you should have been able to have it all operational and working and have skimmed 240,000 barrels within 68 hours, that will be a very important answer. That will be a very important answer.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I yield the rest of my time.
Representative Peter DeFazio from Oregon.
Well, I'd just like to go back briefly to dispersants. Using the earlier letter and what they have in the letter, again, the 86 letter, just extrapolating, I don't know if you can extrapolate, but that was to do a 1,000 barrel spill. And you said 160 drums, so you would have needed on hand as a contingency for 200,000 barrel spill, 32,000 drums, or something of that magnitude if you're going to disperse it totally. Just to follow up on the chairman's line of questioning, but of course I know that you're maintaining that there's no intention to just disperse it. I'd like to go back to the responses that Mr. Durbin got, because I in addition to having problems with the nameplate, I have problems with recovery. My understanding of your response to Mr. Durbin was that recovery means it's gone, because you said it would either be dispersed or recovered. Yet, your statement says 50% will be recovered at sea, either directly after the spill or at a later time by being washed off the rocks, contained and skimmed off of the water. That is saying it will be in hand. That's recovered. You go on to talk about evaporation and natural dispersing, or perhaps unnatural dispersing with dispersants, and 5% remaining in the environment. So it doesn't seem consistent with the answer you gave him. It says 50% will be recovered at sea, comma, either directly after the spill or at a later time by being washed off the rocks, contained and skimmed off of the water. Do you anticipate it, by any stretch of the imagination, that 50% of this oil will be recovered in those two manners that you list?
Well, you see, nowhere in that did you read the effect of the dispersant, and it was included in that recovery factor. That recovery factor included mechanical pickup, dispersants, and burning, and what was washed off the rocks. Because they're mentioned in the plan. Those items are going to be part of the recovery process. You don't go to dispersant unless you don't think you can get it with mechanical. If you don't think you can get it, then you apply dispersants and try to burn.
Well, I guess what I'm, I guess perhaps you need, you need an English teacher, because the problem here is 50% of the oil will be recovered at sea. Will be recovered. Now, I didn't bring a dictionary. I don't think staff has one. Will be recovered. Now you're saying, well, it won't be recovered, but it'll be dispersed, it'll be burned, it'll be otherwise dissipated, destroyed, or whatever. Now, it doesn't say that. It just says, you're saying that the people of Alaska and the people of the United States should read this plan with a grain of salt and a hell of a lot of inference and background knowledge about nameplate capacity. All right, I'm willing to, I don't know about nameplates. But this is so unequivocal. It doesn't go on to say either by dispersants, either by burning, this or that, because then it goes on to say 15% will evaporate, okay, that 15% will be recovered from the shore, primarily by washing oil off the rocks, recovering the water, 15% will naturally disperse, and approximately 5% will remain in the environment. I mean, that's pretty specific, very specific. It doesn't say anything about, that 50% will be dispersed or otherwise. I mean, it's very specific.
The intent was that it include the effects of burning and dispersants. If our English was poor, I apologize, sir.
Well, okay. On page 355 of the same plan, it says, when you're talking about where the oil will go, it says, although it's not...
If our English was poor, I apologize, sir.
Well... Okay. On page 355 of the same plan, it says, when you're talking about where the oil will go, it says, although it's not...